Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. It is November 29th, so are we there yet?
As Christmas lights are turned on in towns and villages around the country, the burning issue dividing homes and workplaces in every county in the country is, when is too early to stick up the tree and deck the halls with boughs of holly?
Ooh, and for Edward Hayden, chef and lecturer, why wait? Christmas is a go.
Where do you stand on the November decorations debate?
Do you know what, Katie? What I'd first off say to you is, isn't there a change to all things, you know? And those of us that kind of try to retain or remain in the status quo, it's perhaps not the wisest thing to do. So I think, you know, it's to succumb to the resistance is the message, you know. And what I'm going to give you now, Katie, this is me, Edward Hayden, giving you a gentle permission just to slip in and enjoy something that's uncomplicated, because it's not going to ruin your life. It's not going to ruin the world. And when we have so much going on in the world at the minute, you know, these little few twinkling lights will give you that calm, relaxing sense in an unstable world. So fire it up this weekend, Katie, and don't put a bother of thought on it.
So, team drive time, a go. And over with Oliver. Well, no permission needed for Sean White from Palmerstown in Dublin.
What does your house look like at the minute?
It looks like Christmas got sick all over it. That's about it. You know, it's full of decorations, outside decorations, blow-ups.
How many sets of lights have you got?
Probably about 200, I'd say.
200?
Yeah, a lot of lights, yeah.
Did the start out kind of modest and now you've gone a bit Vegas?
Yes, we started off with a couple of little plastic Santas at the hall door, and then it just got bigger and bigger and bigger to where we are now.
And that is how it starts. Just one more elf just to finish it off, and then you're here.
What's the biggest thing that's there?
The biggest thing? Well, of course, the blow-ups would be the biggest, but...
Inflatables.
The inflatables would be the biggest, but we have a big Santa Claus with a cello on the front of the house, just between the two windows.
Okay. There's an 8-foot blow-up Winnie the Pooh.
There is indeed, yeah. The kids love Winnie the Pooh, yeah.
What's on the roof?
We have a train. We have Santa being blown on top of a dolphin. Dolphin's blown Santa up in the air. We have a snowman, Santa climbing up the ladder, Santa juggling a few things in the air. We'd have this lower roof then. We have the carriage, horse and carriage.
Oh, of course.
Santa on a bike. A motorbike, and then we have three wise men,
Mary,
Joseph and JC, yeah.
Ooh, he almost sounds Christmas jaded, and it's not even December. But does he get to have a little break from it all when he goes inside, puts his feet up?
Lorraine is your devoted wife.
She is, yes, yes. I do all the outside and she do most of the inside.
So there's more Christmas happening inside the house?
Oh, yeah, it's just as big inside as there is outside, yeah.
Oh, my God.
And our Christmas tree, and we have a big, in the kitchen, we have two folding tables with a Christmas village on it, and we have some dancing snowmen, dancing, singing polar bear.
Oh, the dancing polar bear. That's a lot of ho, ho, ho. But it's a charity fundraiser. The lights go on at 6 this Sunday with the help of his friend Riley.
Riley will come out as Santa up on the roof at the chimney.
Really? Okay.
And then he'll be waving and so on. And then he'll jump back in the Velox window up on the roof. And then Santa will come
very safely. Certified safety, yeah.
And then Santa will come around the corner on a Harley Davidson and give the kids selection boxes and
things like that.
That sounds
amazing.
And the adults will get mince pies.
Lovely.
Warm mince pies.
Oh, that does indeed sound lovely. Meanwhile, on Lyric yesterday, someone's gone rogue.
I'm going to sit back and I'm going to play this. indeed. Lock the door in case management come in quickly. Michael Bublé, we think he's great.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Oh no, Marty. Too soon. Put your Bublé baubles away, sir. Here on Team Playback, at least we will be sticking to the December protocol. But what you certainly will be doing over the next few weeks is making that list, checking it twice, and getting ready to spend. According to the Irish League of Credit Unions, 1 in 10 will borrow to pay for all the ho-ho-ho. Here's financial planner Owen McGee.
The average household, some research would suggest, it's around €1,400 is what Christmas will cost. If you've no kids, about €800 is what it will cost. What I would love people to do, if they're listening right now, they're not sure where they're going to go for Christmas this year in terms of spending-wise, what it's going to cost them, sit down with a pen and piece of paper and literally write down everyone you're going to buy for and how much you're going to spend on them. If you've done some presents already, put it in there, because the biggest Christmas surprise you're getting this year is when you tot up that number and you look at the bottom of it and you say how much you're spending on gifts. And we haven't even touched groceries or anything else, just on gifts. And then once you've got that list, David, you have to stick to it. And you have to be very disciplined about, Owen said he's going to spend €50 on David, or maybe €20. I don't know you that well yet, David, right? But I might spend €20 on you. So what we'll do is I'll spend €20 on David. And if I end up spending 25, I have to take a fiver off somebody else.
Well, that's okay with me.
And he recommended Chris Kindle's Secret Santa, budgeting and keeping it low. And this might be something to bear in mind.
David, I really ask your listeners to think about this for a second. What did you get for Christmas last year? Tell me three things you got for Christmas. Most people by March have forgotten about the things, because life is not about things, it's about experiences. And I would also suggest that if you just thought a little bit for a second, give yourself 15, 20 seconds to think about how you felt last Christmas Day, and you'll fairly quickly remember some of the feelings. You might have been sad, you might have been happy, but I'd be fairly sure that you'll remember how you felt in and around Christmas, the people you saw. Life is not about things, and the problem we have is the things cost money, the experiences don't in general, and you need to focus on that side of things. Just be careful and conscious about where the money leakage happens over the next couple of weeks, because there will be a lot of it. The emotions are high, you're happy, it's a good time of year, and therefore the purse strings can loosen a little bit.
And staying with that theme, we turn to Kel Gallivan, a.k.a. Mrs. Smart Money. She had seasonal top tips coming out of her ears, but started off with your psychological buttons. Know them.
You're looking for the dopamine hit.
You're looking for the
shopping
dopamine hit.
Shopping can give you sometimes.
Yes.
Short-lived.
Absolutely, because our lives are so busy. It's nice to have that little escape. And there's a couple of things where our human brain is wired, and that dopamine hit is really important. Pressing that buy button can feel really, really good. But also there's huge things being handled in the background that we may or may not realise that are happening. So, for example, humans are wired to avoid loss, to have loss aversion. We hate losing things. So when you see a sale or something and the sale says, look, there's only two left in stock.
Yes.
Or the sale ends midnight.
Very clever, isn't it?
Yes, because we feel loss as humans way more than we feel gain. And if you think, oh, I'll never get that thing again, that urgency kicks in. And when you press the buy button, you feel even better. And then you've topped that with another human piece. And that's this thing called self-efficacy, where we like to be seen to be good at things. We like to know that we're savvy.
Right.
And you see something and you go, oh, this is a great sale. It's like 70% off and it's the dress or top or whatever it is. You go, I'm a savvy shopper, forgetting that. So if you have 70% off sale dress, for example, to use what you said, and it's only a 24-hour sale, and you press that buy button, that's a trifecta of feel good. And that's there every time you go online when
you're
shop.
You're going to want to do it again and again.
Yes.
And if you are going Christmas shopping, don't forget about January.
Pay January 1st. Now, what I mean when I say that is you look at your bills. So you look, do you have mortgage or rent? What are your utility bills? What are the bare bones to get you through January?
Prioritise all those.
Absolutely. Put that money aside. Like, just put it away in a different savings account or somewhere out of sight, out of mind. So that means if you've your little audit done, you're going to get through Christmas feeling better. But also, there's such great peace of mind to know that January's sorted. and you can enjoy yourself then.
Enjoy yourself then, because the enjoyment now that kind of makes January sore, isn't it?
Oh, very fine advice from Mrs. Smart Money with Oliver. But oh, a little bit grinchy. So let's turn to something Christmas adjacent. It's hard to believe, but it's 30 years since we were introduced to Woody and Buzz.
According to my Nava computer, the...
Shut up! Just shut up, you idiot!
Sheriff, this is no time to panic.
This is the perfect time to panic! I'm lost, Andy is gone, they're gonna move from their house in 2 days and it's all your fault!
My fault? If you hadn't pushed me out of the window in the first place...
Oh, yeah, well, if you hadn't shown up your stupid little cardboard spaceship and taken away everything that was important to me...
Don't talk to me about importance. Because of you, the security of this entire universe is in jeopardy.
What? What are you talking about?
Right now, poised at the edge of the galaxy, Emperor Zurg has been secretly building a weapon with the destructive capacity to annihilate an entire planet. I alone have information that reveals this weapon's only weakness. And you, my friend, are responsible for delaying my rendezvous with Star Command.
You are a toy! You weren't the real Buzz Lightyear. You're an action figure. You are a child's plaything.
You are a sad, strange little man, and you have my pity. Farewell.
So good. And hang on to your slinkies, because Toy Story is having its birthday. And as Stephen Benedict told Rick on Arena, this 1995 film was a game changer.
When Toy Story arrived, it provided a new look to animation. And although the movie was rapturously received and embraced by audiences, there were a few skeptics amongst the animation fraternity themselves, because they were saying, we're not so much concerned about what is on offer here, it's how it's being offered, because they were convinced that computers were going to take over everything. Does this sound in any way, shape, familiar?
We may be having a 1995 discussion in 2025.
Yeah. So what they did, what John Lasseter, the director of the film, had to do when he came out to release the film and he was doing the publicity, he was basically explaining the computers were nothing more than a very new set of very, very expensive pencils. And so if I can draw a comparison between what Lasseter was doing at Pixar, and we go back into the history of art, we go back to 1841, there was an American painter called John G. Rand, and he was browned off having to go down to the supplier's shop, buy pigment in dry form, go home, grind the colours, mix them with oil and thinner, and then and only then finally address the canvas. So he came up with an idea. How about we stuff paint into a tube? And that liberated the artist from the studio. They could go out into the fields. And because of that, then we have a new art form called Impressionism. So Pixar are to animation what John G. Rand was to painting. That is how revolutionary the arrival of Pixar and Toy Story is.
But as revolutionary as the technology would prove, it all comes back to the writing.
The brilliant thing about Toy Story is the toys love Andy more than he loves them. And that's what kids want to know. So that's the emotional core of it. But the thing is, when they were making Toy Story, they ran into an enormous amount of difficulty. And so much so that two years into making the film, they had to stop, because they sat down, they watched a very, very rough cut of the movie, and they said, this isn't working at all. And why wasn't it working? The tone is completely wrong. Woody was a bully in the original version, and they said the tone is completely wrong, it's not going to connect with audiences. They shut the whole thing down, and Pixar and Disney were seriously considering axing the entire film, ditching the entire thing, but they decided, no, we'll go back and we'll start again from scratch. And when they started again from scratch, they started to engage with two specific writers, incredibly gifted writers. One was a guy called Pete Docter, and he went on to write and direct Up and Inside Out, both of which won the Academy Award. Another writer on the team was Andrew Stanton, who won the Academy Award for Finding Nemo and WALL-E. So when Toy Story was released in 1995, it became the first animated feature film ever to be nominated for Best Original Screenplay. So it's the storytelling, not the technology. But for me, I think the secret sauce is the music, and Randy Newman's music, because the title of the song, You've Got a Friend in Me, that for me is what the secret sauce of the whole film is about. It's about friendship. It's about knowing you have a place to live, knowing you have a place of being safe, and knowing that you're loved. It's that simple and that hard.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks
rough ahead, and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed. You just remember what your old past said, boy, you got a friend in me. Yeah, you got a friend in me.
Oh, still so good. One to rewatch. Back in a bit. Welcome back. This week, a major overhaul of our migration system from Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan. And while, yes, he believed inward migration could be a good thing, the rate at which it was happening he described as a worry. Our population increased by 1.6% last year, which was seven times the European average. Jim O'Callaghan spoke to David McCullough on Thursday and they got into the numbers and in particular the statistics of those coming here seeking asylum.
People seeking temporary protection or seeking asylum are a very, very small proportion of the overall increase.
Well, let's look at it in terms of the numbers. In terms of the people who came here from other EU countries or the UK, last year that was around 32,000. Last year, the people who came here looking for asylum was 18,500. People who came last year looking for temporary protection, 10,000. People who were granted student permits, 60,000. People who came here in terms of granted work visas from my department, 12,500. So it's not the majority. But it's a significant percentage of the numbers of people coming
it's
into
about
Ireland.
10%.
It is. Well, it's.
It's gone down this year.
Yeah, it's gone down it's this year.
It's
about 10%. But the measures I announced yesterday affect the people who are here from non-EEA
but a
countries
lot of people
who are here in work permits.
Yeah,
as well.
I appreciate that. We'll talk about that in a moment. But a lot of people would say that the strictest tightening of the rules relates to people coming here.
Okay, but can I also emphasise this? Like, it would be a denial of reality if I was to say that people seeking asylum isn't a more complicated and contentious issue than other people who come in here.
And then they got into the issue of accommodation.
International protection applicants who are working are going to be asked to contribute, are going to be made to contribute between 10 and 40% of their weekly income towards the accommodation provided by the state, even if it's a tent.
Well, people who come to Ireland, they cannot work if they apply for asylum for a period of 6 months, okay? Mm. So where we have difficulties in providing accommodation, we put people in the first instance into tents. The vast majority of IPASS accommodation, and I've been around and seen it, is of good quality, much higher than what's in other European Union countries.
Well, HICWA report in March said there was problems with governance, with risk management, with safeguarding. In one case, six unrelated adults were sharing a bedroom. Another case, a family of eight sharing a very small mobile home with two newborn babies. If you're going to charge people, they might expect a better standard of accommodation.
Sorry, the fact that we have HICWA going around doing assessments and the fact that I have officials in my department assessing IPASS accommodation shows how seriously we take our obligation to ensure that there is good accommodation available. We have a requirement under the Material Conditions Directive to provide accommodation. That applies to every other European Union country as well. I can tell you, Ireland provides a much higher quality of accommodation than the vast majority of other EU countries. At present, we're accommodating 33,000 people in IPASS. Last September, we did an assessment and were able to identify that there's around 7,600 people in IPASS who could make a contribution because they are working. I think it's reasonable that if somebody is working, that they make a contribution to their accommodation.
OK, the Irish Times reporting this morning that the charges won't apply to people living in direct provision who have been granted refugee status. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Once you get status, you've access to the full range of housing supports available to all Irish residents. So I'm not in the business of being a landlord providing accommodation for people who have status to be in Ireland.
And finally, the issue of family reunification and just how much money do you need if you want your family to come and live here with you.
Making it more difficult for migrants, whether they're people granted asylum or those here on work permits, to bring family members here. In order to bring children here, you have to be earning €44,300 for one child, €54,200 for two children, €64,200 for three children. Now, at the moment, the minimum wage is around €28,000. So for many jobs, for care workers, for food production, for the hospitality industry, jobs vital to our society, we are effectively saying you can come here and work, but you can't have a normal family life.
Well, I have to look again at the numbers of people coming in. And again, these are people who are not asylum seekers. If you look at the numbers in respect of the work permit people, the non-EEA family reunification, 22,000 people came under family reunification last year. I suppose one of the characteristics of family reunification is that in many instances, people are coming in who are either minor children or dependent parents. And they're people who require to be cared for, and they're people who, if the sponsor bringing them in isn't going to be able to look after them, the state's going to have to look after them. So I have to take into account the financial cost that this is going to have on the state. And that is why, in respect of the rules that were announced yesterday in respect of family reunification for both non-EEA and indeed asylum seekers, there has to be self-sufficiency applied. And in order to bring somebody in who's a member of your family, you're going to have to be able to show that you'll be able to support them yourselves. And I think that is a fair proposal. Maybe you think it's unfair on the person who's applying for reunification, but I also have to take into account the interests of the Irish public and in terms of the cost of the bringing people in who the state then ultimately ends up responsible for.
Okay, but, I mean, talk about the individual, the care worker. We're saying to them, come to this country, care for us in our old age. But we're not going to care for you. We're not going to allow you to have a normal family.
I know, but look, I'm not forcing people to come to Ireland.
Well, we need those people to come to Ireland nobody, or we won't have care homes.
I know, but can I just say to you, nobody's forcing people to come here. People are coming here because there are work opportunities here for those who are coming under the non-EEA avenue. And they've made a decision themselves to come here in the same way as Irish people today make decisions to go to other countries. And just because you make a decision to go to another country doesn't mean that you have an automatic entitlement to bring your whole family with you.
Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan with David McCullough on Thursday. But earlier on Morning Ireland, Cian put this to John Lannan, CEO of Limerick-based refugee and migrants' rights organisation, Thuras.
Will these measures make Ireland less attractive for people seeking asylum or refugee status?
People will always need to escape from persecution and war. We have well over 100 million people that have been forcibly displaced in the world right now as a result of war, of persecution, of climate change. Some of them will continue to come to Ireland, to have to come to Ireland to seek protection wherever they can. So no, it's not going to stop the arrival of people. But we also have to bear in mind that when we look at the numbers of people that come and go to Ireland, the numbers of people seeking international protection are very, very low. Up to the end of September, we only had 9,500 people who did that here in Ireland. So there's a disproportionate and a focus on a small cohort of people who do, incidentally, all just want to get on with their lives, start working, bring their families here. It's going to be next to impossible for someone working in a low-paid job for less than a year in the current rental market to do that.
From Morning Ireland on Thursday. On Sunday evening, another opportunity to hear the voice and work of the late Moncón McGann. The series is called Moncón's A to Z of Ireland, and he started with the Ice Age, A for Age, and went all the way up to Malinhead in Donegal.
I'm standing on a rock overlooking this sheer drop into the Atlantic Ocean and north, straight for the North Pole.
14,000 years ago, the kilometre-thick layer of ice that covered Ireland melted back into the sea after 2.5 million years of repeated glaciation.
And on Malinhead, it looks like the Ice Age just happened, like a few decades ago. You can still see the land has been left entirely bare.
And after this age of ice, this land then witnessed a great arrival. The arrival of the first grasses and wildflower seeds that came tumbling into the barren tundra of Britain and Ireland. And they took root here, creating vast open meadows. Then, about 1,000 years later, the first juniper trees arrived. Stubby, rugged evergreens, preparing the way for a few lone birch seeds. Once even one of these stoic pioneer birches managed to take root and establish itself, it began sending out 15 million feather-light seeds each and every year to colonise the land and enrich the soil for others. Soon we had woodland, And along comes the giant deer and the reindeer. The hare, the otter, the Irish stoat and badger, the natterjack toad and birds and bats and insects. And plants too, of course, like St. Debbuck's heath, fleabane, kidney saxifrage, and the arbutus tree, all coming across land bridges from the British mainland and across the ocean from Europe. What the glaciers left behind them became our playground. Here is where we blossomed as a race. We cleared the forests, worked the land to feed and shelter ourselves, and in doing so, created much of the landscape that we know today.
Oh, how lovely to hear that voice again. Moncon's A to Z of Ireland. This week, talks continued to try to end the war in Ukraine. And on Tuesday, well, some bit of news that for a moment looked hopeful. Here's Katie with BBC presenter in Washington, Katrina Perry.
Peace in our time. What are we hearing in the States today?
I think don't hold your breath at this point, Katie, anyway, but it would seem that we are closer to that than we have been at any point recently. The White House is describing it as tremendous progress having been made towards a peace deal in, you know, as they're putting it, bringing both Ukraine and Russia to the table. Now, that is not to the same table at the same time, as far as we understand it at this point. And, you know, there was some briefing going on earlier this morning that there had been a kind of full deal reached, but that seems to be, that was somebody getting a bit ahead of themselves. But rather, it would appear that Ukraine and the US have agreed the terms of an agreement. And there are a few details still to be ironed out. Now, again, the White House describing those as a few delicate but not insurmountable details, but we understand that they are quite serious details, such as where border lines would be drawn, what land, if any, Ukraine would be expected to cede to Russia, which we know is something that President Zelensky has said he cannot and will not do, and a few other issues involving NATO membership, size of Ukrainian army, and so on. So progress being made, but it would seem that there's still quite a long road ahead.
So how open is Russia to a deal? David McCullough put this to Keir Giles, a journalist specialising in Russian affairs.
Can the Russians be brought to a deal with this revised plan?
There's no reason to think that that will happen. Russia has not been willing to end the fighting, even when they've been presented with all of their demands by President Trump trying to enforce them on Ukraine. And the fact that we are now in a damage limitation mode, trying to row back from Russia's surrender terms that were put forward by the United States in this 28-point plan, is an indication of how successful Russia has been in promoting the idea that they are going to win and in making sure that that's the baseline for negotiations. Everything that's happening at the moment is trying to claw back from that. And the challenge that we have is the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Russia over the head of Ukraine, where the US appears to have convinced itself that Russia's victory is inevitable, so speed it up.
Yeah, and a big role being played by Donald Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, who does seem to have quite a close relationship with the Kremlin.
Well, for anybody that has not seen it, there have now been transcripts released of Witkoff's conversations with his Russian opposite number, where he's effectively conspiring with the Russians for how to sell their surrender plan to Trump. So Witkoff is an active part of this Russian campaign to try to get their message across into Western media for how this war should end. And trouble is, Western media, as well as the United States, have swallowed it hook, line and sinker. And that's why that's been established as the starting point for negotiations, as opposed to starting with a clean slate and trying to work towards something that's actually viable and sustainable, let alone protecting those interests of Ukraine that are fundamental to its continued existence. So it's been a huge victory for Russia with the assistance of Witkoff and Trump.
Now a US delegation is expected in Moscow next week for talks. But Putin is not for turning, or at least that's the rhetoric. Yesterday, Kian got the view of Siobhan O'Grady, Washington Post Ukraine bureau chief.
President Putin said yesterday that in principle, the Russians were willing to fight until the last Ukrainian. And so that was a pretty alarming rhetoric, obviously, and confirmed what most Ukrainians still believe, which is that Russia does not want Ukraine to exist as a state and is trying to eliminate Ukrainian people at any cost.
And with Ukraine refusing to concede any territory as it stands, a peace deal seems unlikely. So, militarily, where do things stand?
But in terms of the battlefield itself, how much progress has Russia made?
It would take several years at the current pace that they are fighting to take the remainder of Donetsk region. And so that is also something that I think Putin definitely plays down in his public comments. He said yesterday that if they don't agree diplomatically, then his forces will take it by force. And for Ukrainians, it's laughable, honestly. I've talked to soldiers who are mocking this kind of statement because they're like, you know, okay, then we'll keep fighting for several more years and you'll keep taking a few hundred meters at the cost of thousands of lives of Russians as well. And so this is coming at even the small gains that Russia's making, even hundreds of meters, come at huge, huge losses. And currently, yes, Russia has enough soldiers to continue fighting at that pace because their population is so much larger than Ukraine's. But at a certain point, you know, they may even run out of the manpower to do that and may face other social problems that will prevent them from doing this militarily. So Putin is trying to ramp up the rhetoric and make it seem to the Americans like he really does have this military advantage. Of course, Russia does have an advantage, but it's not large enough and they are not making enough progress for Ukraine to want to cow to their demands.
Washington Post bureau chief Siobhan O'Grady with Cian on Morning Ireland yesterday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Is there any more to say about the Beatles? Apparently, yes. The Beatles anthology has now been reissued with a remastered documentary series and a new music collection. Paul McLoone is a super fan and he joined Rick on Arena.
Demo versions, shortened versions, moments that occur within their recording history. Some of them are full songs. Some of them, let's have a listen to this.
Yeah.
This is called Take 29 of I Will.
1, 2, 3. Who knows how long I've loved you? You know I love you still. Will I wait a lonely lifetime? If you want me to, I won't.
Yes, you will.
That's 35 seconds long, that track in its entirety. Does that add to the Beatles' legacy?
It doesn't add to the legacy, probably not. But what it does add to is your sense of them as people, you know. And it's wonderful to hear them just mess around the cat. In fact, you know what? They could have put that on the. They could have put that version on the White Album, and we'd be saying it's great. Do you know what I mean? There's a kind of a. They get away with stuff as well with the Beatles. Like McCartney's continued it. Obviously, he's the one who's had the most of a career since the Beatles. And I've noticed that I enjoy McCartney's music, even when he's very, very audibly just, you know, messing around. He's not really he's kind of just having a bit of a. It's loose and it's kind of almost throwaway, but still, there's something brilliant about it.
And if there are two kinds of people in the world, as Aideen told Oliver, when it comes to the music in his films, Martin Scorsese, well, he's with the Stones.
He's a massive fan.
He is a massive fan. It almost becomes comical because in 2008 he released a Rolling Stones concert film called Shine a Light. And I've counted about 14 appearances of Rolling Stones on his filmography, and I could, there are possibly even more. Interestingly, with Shine a Light, he didn't use the song we're about to hear, which was Gimme Shelter. It features on three occasions. It features in Goodfellas in 1990. This was sort of in a montage where our leading guy, Henry's criminal activity is a little out of hand. He uses it 5 years later in Casino, again, quite a montage of violence. But perhaps the best use of it, I think, is the opening in The Departed in 2006. It weaves into the opening as we meet Jack Nicholson's horrific crime boss. And just, you know, if you listen here, the opening line of Gimme Shelter is, "Oh, a storm is threatening."
Yeah.
It's a hell of a tune.
No wonder he uses it a few times. It says a lot, doesn't it?
Oh, they are not wrong there. We might have to go back to that one. But for now, a gear change. If you're thinking of getting a little bit of, how should we put this, work done for the Christmas, a little nip, a little tuck, perhaps a wee injection, well, this might be of interest. Gwen phoned into Ciarán on Liveline. She'd written a book, and for the launch she had, understandably, wanted to look her best.
So I started looking online at, you know, places that did this surgery. And I noticed that one clinic in particular kept popping up on the socials, you know, and advertising for this particular thing that I wanted to do. So I contacted the clinic, and I got a consultation online through WhatsApp with a surgeon based in the UK. And the consultation was done online over the phone. And he said that I was a fantastic candidate for this procedure. And if I wanted to go ahead, you know, think about it and get back to them, which is what I did.
Okay, so the surgery itself then, this blepharoplasty, is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm.
Blepharoplasty.
It is, yeah.
So the idea is it smoothens out the skin around the eye, you get rid of crow's feet or droopy eyelids, all that sort of stuff, is it?
It is, but it's an actual surgery, so they'll cut away, you know, the loose skin, whatever extra skin is there, they will take away and stitch it up. And it's supposed to be a 90-minute procedure. Very straightforward is what I was told. And that's what I expected, but that's not what I got.
She had the surgery here in Ireland and was told it had gone well. They booked her a taxi home.
And I noticed that in the taxi on the way home, my eyes felt like they were watering. So I put my hands up to my eyes and, in fact, they were bleeding, particularly my right eye, which worried me. So when I got home, I called the surgeon and I asked him, is this normal? And he said, yes, just put some Steri-Strips on it and put some pressure on it and, you know, you'll be fine.
And before you left the clinic, Gwen, did they say anything about this, about the possibility that you might start bleeding from your eyes in the taxi home?
No, absolutely not. There was nothing said about any complications or what might happen, or, you know, what could happen. Nothing at all. Because maybe if I had known at the time, I probably would have thought twice about it. But it wasn't explained to me, you know.
Well, for the interest of transparency, we obviously reached out to the clinic involved here, and they say that every treatment carries some level of risk and all patients are fully informed of this risk and provide consent before proceeding. And they go on to say more about the level of care. They provide the high level of care. We'll get to that in a moment. But they would say, listen, all of this stuff is explained. But as you say, you're in the taxi, the quite literally blood is coming from your eyes and you're told to ice pack it and then Steri-Strips and all will be fine. Is that it?
And all will be fine.
But over the next few days, her eyes became inflamed. She was due to go on holiday and contacted the aftercare clinic, which was based in the UK, to see if she was clear to travel. They gave her the okay, but things only deteriorated.
So the skin underneath your eye is kind of hanging loose. Is that how you'd describe it?
There was so much skin taken away from under my eye that my eyelid was sitting way down, way off of my eye. So it was kind of hanging down, drooping down.
Sorry, this is an awful way to put it, Gwen, but stick with me. But I mean, again, I'm just trying to get people to imagine. It's almost like if you got your two fingers, put them underneath the outside of each eye and just pulled your skin down. That's what it looked like, did it?
Exactly. Exactly.
Like a
That's
kid
exactly
making a face.
What it looked like. That's exactly. Exactly what it looked like. And Ciarán, I was actually asked by a few people, was I in an accident? Was I burned? It was that bad.
Oh,
that's
God.
What I looked like.
She contacted the clinic, who said her surgeon no longer worked there and she would need to go to the UK for another surgeon to see her. It would turn out that they would tell her that too much skin had been taken from her eyes and the clinic offered to fix what had gone wrong. She declined. She's now had 6 reconstructive surgeries just to get back the function in her eyes, all at a cost of €3,000.
How much of a toll was all this putting on you?
I can't describe it, Ciarán. I ended up on antidepressant medication, anti-anxiety medication. I couldn't sleep at night time because there was so much skin missing that I had to tape my eyes closed at night time. And during the day, I had to tape my eyes up so that they wouldn't kind of hang down as much. Constant headaches. I mean, it was just physically, it took its toll, and emotionally, psychologically took its toll. As you say, when I looked in the mirror, I didn't recognise myself. It was horrific, absolutely horrific.
And while many were very sympathetic, others were not.
You know, there's a certain sense of shame that comes with it because most people have been really, really good and nice and understanding. But there's other people who say, why did you get that done in the first place? You didn't need that.
I was going to ask you that, Gwen. I mean, if it was another, if you'd gone in for a hip replacement and something had gone wrong, I mean, people wouldn't suggest it was your own fault. But despite the fact that it's much more common than it used to be, I suspect there is still a bit of kind of a rolling of the eyes, pardon the pun, unintended.
Yeah.
You know, when you tell people this from some of them, that they think, this is what comes to cosmetic surgery.
Yes, and I did come up against that a few times. But, you know, the cosmetic industry today, it's kind of a part of women's makeup routines now. It's that commonplace. And I thought that that's what I was getting. It was straightforward. You know, it wasn't a big deal. Lots of people get this done. And, you know, there's very little downtime. Obviously, in my case, that's not what happened.
Mm. Gwen with Ciarán on Liveline. Now, picture the scene. You're togged out, ready to play to represent your country. And then this happens.
Republic of Ireland under 19 women's team had to sing Our Own Naveen themselves before yesterday's European Championship qualifier against Sweden. As the players lined up for the anthem, the wrong anthem was played in the stadium.
So, what did the girls do?
Well, they had to sing it for themselves.
And they did. Make you proud, wouldn't it?
Yeah, tough on them though. To have that rigmarole before the match.
It is, but then it's a kind of like a together moment before a game, as in, you know, no matter what slight is put in front of us, we'll rally together and sing really badly, but at least sing together, you know?
Yeah, not everyone's
did
a good
they win?
Singer. No, unfortunately, they lost 3-1, so maybe you can blame it on the anthem. It's not clear if there was actually where the error arose, if the assumption was that God Save the King was the Irish anthem or if the wrong button was hit. We don't know what went on over there. But anyway, it's gone viral, to say the least.
Aux, but we will leave it there. On Thursday, Peter Kay chatted to Oliver and they got to talking about car journeys and when you twiddle the radio and land on this.
Listening to him reading out the dead at 6 o'clock, that's always a joy when you're driving.
Local death notices.
The local death notices are always a joy.
They should do them twice.
Know, followed up by Taylor Swift or something straight after.
They should do them twice because there's the real names and then there's the names everyone knows them by.
They should come on. That's exactly right. The ones that they should read them out by the middle names, Oliver.
Peter Kay, Michael, of course, as we know.
Yeah, of course. The other way around. What's your middle name, Oliver?
Oh, it's Bernard.
Bernard, well, you'd be Bernard Callan then, wouldn't you?
I would, yeah.
Or are you really Bernard Callan? Well,
maybe I am.
Have you flipped them for showbiz purposes?
I've hated that name all my life, but my grandfather was known as Barney, which is where it comes from. And Barney's a better one, I think.
Barney's all right. Barney's quite comforting. I like Barney's quite comforting and cuddly. I like Barney.
It is, yeah.
Don't mind Bernard, but, you know, it's not as glamorous as Barney.
What's your middle name?
John.
Steady name. Kills all crack. We move on to the drag name.
Do you have a drag name, or is that
no? How do I put together a drag name again?
Okay, so
is it broadcastable? First of all, I probably should.
I would hope so. Let's go with that.
The criteria.
Did you have any animals when you were growing up?
Animals, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What was the name?
The first pet is it?
Yeah. Let's go first pet.
Fluffy.
Fluffy. Okay, that's a strong start. Oh, and then the street name that you grew up on.
It's a townland.
Okay. What was it?
Actually, if I go for Drumlusty, it actually would work
that
very well.
Works.
It?
Fluffy Drumlusty.
Fluffy Drumlusty.
Set up the Instagram right now. Grab it before one of your listeners does.
The culty drag.
Yeah, I love it.
And now I feel we know too much. Bernard Fluffy Drumlusty. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.